listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 41st installment of our ongoing conversation, after a brief, I'd say a month-long hiatus, with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. And we're now going to start focusing on what happened, beginning with the Khrushchev period and going up to 1991 and all of the things that happened, leading up to the Yeltsin years. And so, Luciana, I've missed the conversations with you, and let's pick it up where we left off.
I'm very happy to be back, too.
Good.
Me too. I mean, the question for today that we pose is, for our conversation, is why did socialism collapse in the Soviet Union in between 1989-91? So we begin by, or I begin by saying that this event is, most people acknowledge, most sensible people acknowledge, was a catastrophe for the whole world. What followed was exactly what Stalin predicted in 1924. He said that such a collapse of the Soviet Union, would leave particularly the colonial world completely exposed to Western, neo-colonization, at that time it would have been called just Western colonization, among many other evils. Now, these other evils include, we can see in retrospect, he said it in 1924, but in retrospect we can say that they include the neoliberal global economic offensive on workers' rights,
right,
now 40 years old. And this has created obscene levels of wealth concentration in few hands and massive global poverty and massive mass migration. This economic war on the world, which we call neoliberal, is accompanied by military wars, ongoing wars on the Middle East, the economic wars and threats of war on Russia and China, the relentless advance by NATO through Eastern Europe to the borders of Russia, and in East Asia, the so far unsuccessful attempts to subvert the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has borders with both Russia and China. So we can safely argue, I think, that the destruction of the Soviet Union, both from inside, which we will discuss, and outside, has exposed the world to a state of permanent and ultimate threat of nuclear war. So the threat of war to the planet, we can conclude, cannot have been the Soviet Union, because it is now gone.
Right.
So it is important to determine what were the causes of its destruction, because the reconstruction of the world for peace depends on understanding what happened to socialism in the Soviet Union. So I go on, if I may. Now, what can we discard regarding the causes of this collapse? Now, we can discard the conclusion of Western Sovietologists, because they have vested interests in defaming socialism. These bought Western liquidationists, as I call them, offer the explanation that the USSR was the empire of evil and a totalitarian state. Now, these are meaningless words, because they reflect the bourgeois criminalization of the Soviet Union since its birth in 1917. Now, a significant contribution to this criminalization has been the collaboration of the Western, both radical and reformist left, has been the collaboration of these two, you know, radical and reformist left, in propagating it, especially ever since 1956, with Khrushchev's demonization of Soviet socialism. The Western left has a great deal of responsibility. So we can discard the analysis of bourgeois economists, too, because they repeat the tautology that the Soviet Union, quote, collapsed because communist economy cannot function. So now we have to ask, what would be a constructive explanation of why the Soviet Union folded? So I intend to concentrate on the economic problems of Soviet socialism in the 1980s. In that regard, we often hear, without evidence and almost as a cliche, that the Soviet economy was collapsing. But this is false. Even the most attentive anti-communist scholars are ready to admit it. GDP grew in the Soviet Union at much higher levels than Western economies, and grew far more than it is growing today in Europe and the USA. And for specific graphs and facts, I would refer readers to a book I read last summer, Roger Kieran, Thomas Kenny, Socialism Betrayed, Behind the Collapse of the Soviet Union. And they will get there, the specifics, which, you know, perhaps we can go on later on, but this is a general presentation today. So, let me just see. Just 1 second.
Not a problem. I'm looking, meanwhile, through the introduction to the book you just cited, Socialism Betrayed, Behind the Collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, very good book.
And, you know, they talk about, you know, some of the difficulties in doing an analysis of something that happened so recently, on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
You know, as a matter of fact, the process of betrayal is something that was going on almost from the beginning, and you know, from 1917, and we've been you know, having detailed conversations about that process over, you know, over the last year.
And you and I have, indeed.
And so, you know, that is something to keep in mind also. So it is quite possible to chart the path to the collapse.
Yeah, well, contrary, what our conversations sought or maybe succeeded, I don't know, in pointing out is that there was never a monolithic Communist Party in the Soviet Union. I mean, you don't eliminate classes and class interests just by doing a revolution. Things continue. There are, so within the what we have been saying, I think, is that within the Soviet Communist parties, there were different classes, class interests, as will become obvious if I continue now. You know, the Bolsheviks were, in my opinion, always the minority. Well, I don't want to retrace all our conversation. Let me just go on now. But the Communist Party, contrary to how it's presented in the West, in the Soviet Union, was never a monolith. There were always struggling classes because communism hadn't yet happened.
Right.
And it would, you know, require communism to, at least in theory, to eliminate classes.
Right. And, you know, so, you had a bunch of theory. Let me interrupt for one second. The Zilas in Yugoslavia, for example, people that had written about, you know, bureaucrats constituting some new class and, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. But and, you know, there was a lot of argument back and forth about that. But in fact, it wasn't. That's not a new class. A class is about where you stand in relation to the means of production, if you own it or if it owns you, basically, and if you're an appendage to it. So, and you know, there were many moves that were taken, beginning with the NEP back in the early 20s, and, you know, all the way through beginning really in earnest in the post-war period with Khrushchev, where capitalism was restored. And there were institutions that were, you know, placed into existence, like Berezovka stores in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc, where some things that were not available in the stores of the Soviet Union because of the economic blockade by the West could be purchased, but only for dollars or marks or other Western currencies. And what would happen is that people who, like the guy who delivers tomatoes to the market in his truck, suddenly would start showing up at the market with an empty truck, sell the tomatoes behind the in-tourist hotel to the Westerners for dollars and marks or whatever, and then go into the Berezovka store and buy a Japanese tape recorder or whatever the thing was that they wanted. And there were a variety of things both at the ground level like that and also at the international level with the you know, the IMF and other organizations that allowed borrowing and certain types of international commerce with the West, but always under the control of the West, and they used that to, you know, to create crises when the time was ripe. So anyway, you had all this stuff going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So yeah, to continue, then I was saying that the GDP in the Soviet Union actually grew at much higher levels than Western economies, and grew far more than it is growing today in Europe, certainly. What is it in Europe? 1.5?
It's not 7 or 8 or 9%.
No. In Europe and the USA. No, basic needs such as food, rent, energy were fully satisfied. Unemployment had disappeared. Free and good public services were available to all. Industrial and technological sectors, for goodness sake, first man in space, were often more advanced than capitalist ones. There was a cultural production and an infinitely superior education in quality and popular diffusion than in capitalist countries. I don't have to remind readers who heard me before that, in effect, the Republic of Russia, the Soviet Republic of Russia, was dumped a lot of money in the Asian republics in terms of preserving their culture, right, building libraries, right, having houses of translation, etc., etc.
Right.
So globally, the economy of the USSR was in good health.
Yeah, I mean, the relationship between, say, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic and, say, Kyrgyzstan or mm-hmm. Uzbekistan or whatever, quite different from the relationship between the United States and, say, you know, Peru or, you know, someplace else in the Western Hemisphere, you know, Puerto Rico for that matter.
Different.
Way different. And just, you know, you glanced past very quickly First Man in Space, etc. Okay, April 12th, 1961, Yuri Gagarin goes into outer space. That is less than 16 years after the end of World War II, when the Soviet Union was devastated, suffered 20 million, 30 million dead people, every city shelled for months and months and months and months, half of the economic base destroyed, the other half relocated, and yet they had the first person in space, and that was 5 years after they, or 4 years after they put the first satellite in space.
Yes, and that was, of course, not the Khrushchev legacy. That had
correct.
Been prepared by the former administration.
That's correct.
I mean, you know, that Khrushchev took credit for that in his speech, in his secret speech in demonizing Stalin in 1956. But you don't put a man in space in 4 years. Gagarin was born. How old was Gagarin when he went out into space?
He was born in 1934, so...
There you go.
Yeah, so he was not quite...
Completely
he was 24.
Educated.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And in fact, this good health of the economy, which is never acknowledged, was also a good health in the socialist republics of Eastern Europe, which were often more advanced in certain sectors of the economy than in equivalent sectors of the USSR economy. All you have to do is think of East Germany and Czechoslovakia economy. So, yet there was a need for reforms, so they say, and these reforms led to the fall of the system. So what happened? Now, we hear often somewhat semi-rational critiques in the West. For example, they cite the Soviet refusal to innovate by introducing market mechanism. Or they say continuing the NEP, the new economic policy started in the 1920s out of extreme necessity by Lenin, that is a kind of partial not return, but partial practice of capitalism. Or we hear that they failed to follow the Chinese model, not understanding a thing about the Chinese model because they don't admit what happened really in the Soviet Union, which
right.
China learned from. Or they say that there is an impossibility of reforming the socialist model itself. So we must specify which aspects of the economy needed reform and weren't reformed. So in 1956, with Khrushchev, the first thing that happened was the ideological rigor, the one that Lenin insisted on and Trotsky objected to, the ideological rigor of the party was loosened. As we mentioned before, it opened up admission to people who hadn't been vetted, who hadn't acted, who hadn't proven action in promoting the proletarian revolution. Anyway, opening of membership to the party. But more consequentially, perhaps the competent control over the socialist economy was loosened. Khrushchev But the new course, they were called the reformists, the new course envisaged a right turn, understood as less centralized planning and more economic liberalism. Now, this didn't apply to all of the economy. It applied to certain sectors. But a good example of a disastrous reform was the disastrous reform of agriculture, which, with the dismantling of the large tractor centers that Stalin had built, in favor of an increased autonomy of the kolkhozes, the agricultural cooperatives, for which Lenin had been in favor of and Stalin developed. Now, what happened is that this caused a substantial loss of productivity in agriculture and an increase in prices that generated discontent in the population. In practice, Khrushchev's application of this line was nothing short of catastrophic. Now, Khrushchev lasted from 56 to 64, and even within his years, he had to sideline out of the party the remaining followers of Stalin's policy, namely Molotov, Malenkov, and people like that, who attempted to talk sense to the party after the secret speech. But they were sidelined. However, they prevailed in removing Khrushchev because the effect on agriculture was devastating and other things. In 1964, he was removed. However, now let's leave aside here the nefarious role of the right-wing opposition, of which Khrushchev was a part, which you said really dates back to Bukharin and to the early years of the revolution, which exploded in the late 1920s in a conflict between Stalin, Bukharin, Trotsky, and Stalin won, initiating the socialism in one country and the industrialization of the country. So this right wing was not a novelty. And Khrushchev was the most vocal supporter of Stalin until he died. So so we can ignore the right wing, the nefarious influence or role of the right, of this right wing opposition who took power with Khrushchev in the falsification of Soviet history, of the Stalin period, and the demonization of Stalin himself, which disrupted the communist parties of the world. So, but the least that can be said is that this tendency, this right-wing tendencies, did not, of reform, as they called it, did not take the form of an orderly transition. Yeah. Of a part of the economy toward the market mechanism, which might have been included in the five-year plans. There was no plan, and this really hit in the 90s. There was no plan to correlate private investments with macro public investment, as China does now. Nothing serious was put in place to reform, let alone regulate, that part of the economy, which was opening to market processes. If this was even the authentic desire of those tendencies within the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was most... Okay, so that segment of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was most conciliatory to the petty bourgeoisie and had been from the beginning, and to the partially capitalist economy represented in Stalin's time by the medium-rich peasantry, of which Khrushchev and the ruling order around him, close to him, were the political representative.
Right.
So what I'm arguing here is, you know, including in what I said, is my, I do feel that being born in a class has some effect in most people. And Khrushchev's class was this, and Trotsky's, was this medium-rich peasantry and Bukharin's.
Right.
Okay, now the new reformist course did not deal with improving the less well-performing sectors of the planned economy, which we can identify in the future. Now, these less well, and I've seen all this in Yugoslavia, so I can, you know, compare. These less well-performing sectors of the planned economy began to show cracks and dysfunctions, because over these, like you said, your tomato, you know, industry, you said, these, within these cracks where the focus of the government was less strict, and these, and so, which we can call unregulated sectors of the planned economy, fell increasingly into private hands. So I want to, in the future, talk about the, the camps for vacation and leisure that the Soviet Union had started.
Yes.
Particularly in Crimea and Georgia.
Yeah.
Those were very vulnerable industries. Those were where you can, with sort of real estate industries.
Right.
A lot happened there, and we can...
Yeah.
Look into that more specifically.
You know, you could also, I mean, you know, let me just back out for a second.
Okay.
I'm looking at Socialism Betrayed, okay? And I'm going to read from that. A brief review of the Soviet Union's accomplishments underscores what was lost. The Soviet Union not only eliminated the exploiting classes of the old order, there's no question about that, they did, but also ended inflation, unemployment, racial and national discrimination, all true, grinding poverty, and glaring inequalities of wealth, income, education, and opportunity, all true. In 50 years, the country went from an industrial production that was only 12% of that in the United States to industrial production that was 80% and agricultural output 85% of the United States. And no society had ever increased living standards and consumption so rapidly in such a short period of time for all its people. And that was true up until China did that over the last two decades. But otherwise, that was it. Employment was guaranteed. Free education available to all, from kindergarten through secondary schools, universities, and after-work schools. Besides free tuition, post-secondary students received living stipends. Free health care existed for all, with about twice as many doctors per person as in the United States. Workers who were injured or ill had job guarantees and sick pay. In the mid-1970s, workers averaged 21 working days of vacation, or a month. Sanitariums, resorts, and children's camps were either free or subsidized, like you were just starting to talk about.
Yeah.
Trade unions had the power to veto firings and recall managers. The state regulated prices and subsidized the cost of food and housing. Rent constituted only 2 to 3% of the family budget. Water and utilities only 4 or 5%. No housing segregation by income. Though some neighborhoods were reserved for senior officials, elsewhere, plant managers, nurses, professors, and janitors lived side by side. The government included cultural and intellectual growth as part of the effort to enhance living standards. State subsidies kept the price of books, periodicals, and cultural events at a minimum. Workers often owned their own libraries. The average family subscribed to at least 4 periodicals. And UNESCO reported the Soviet citizens read more books and saw more films than any other people in the world. And on and on and on. And by the way, yet again, 15 years after the country is practically destroyed and they rebuild it, they put the first human being in outer space.
It's unbelievable. And let's not forget the no more famines, except in 46 as a result of weather and the war, and epidemics curtailed, safe pregnancies, birth rate, increase of lifespan, what do you, is that what you call it?
Yeah, that's right. Life expectancy.
Yeah, life expectancies, all of which went out with the...
the collapse, whatever, the counter-revolution of 1991. Not only that, well, I'm going to close with this, too. Yeah, we're like a minute and a half away. So the last point I want to make, and we'll pick it up here next week, is that is just a sketch of the impact that the Soviet Union had on its own people. Here in the United States, which was about as far removed from the influence of the Soviet Union as you could get, at least due to the best efforts of the elites here, after the Soviet Union collapsed, the Union membership in the United States was cut in half, from 22% to 10%. And going back to Khrushchev.
Now what is it, 11?
Now it's 11. Back when Khrushchev... stopped paying attention, when basically the revisionists came to power in the Soviet Union, and there was no longer any expectation that was offered as an alternative model to American workers, that union membership went from 33% at that time in the United States down to, it's now just shy of 11%. That was just one of the rainbow effects of having the Soviet Union and having the Communist Party sit in power in the Soviet Union, and having this power of the state and the economy in the hands of the Soviets, which translate that Russian word Soviet into workers' council. That's what we've lost since that happened, and we're going to pick it up there next week, Luciana. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Don.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a surprise visit to Afghanistan this week, promising its government American support in ending what he referred to as a 40-year crisis. This year indeed marks the 40th anniversary of the socialist revolution in Afghanistan, which further exacerbated the tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States. But is that really a starting point for Afghanistan's current troubles? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Fawzia Koofi, a member of the Afghan parliament and prominent women's rights activist. Madam Koofi, it's so great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, let me start by getting your reactions to this latest visit by the U.S. Secretary of State, who not only endorsed President Ghani's intention to hold talks with the Taliban, but actually repeated an offer for the United States to engage directly in those talks. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, Afghanistan is still one of the strategic partner for American foreign policy, and America would like to stay engaged in Afghanistan, both in war but also in peace. I think there is a lot of confusion about the peace process in Afghanistan. Definitely people of Afghanistan who have suffered for more than 40 years of war and conflict would like to see a country of peace, because the country is now at the peak of so many conflicts, security, stability, also the upcoming elections. So people want to see the peace and security. And I guess mediation of international community as a guarantor will ensure further sustainability for peace. But the peace process should actually be talks between the one who are fighting, in this case the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban.
And I know that you are personally very concerned that any concessions to the Taliban may reverse the recent gains in women's rights in your country, particularly Article 22 of the Constitution, which proclaims the equality between men and women. Is that really what the Taliban is after? Because my impression has been that their main goal is to see the foreigners out of their country. Do you think they would prioritize the social relations instead?
We would be very happy to see a change of perspective among the Taliban, especially when it comes to their view about women's political and social engagement. Because I remember during the Taliban, I was living in Afghanistan, I remember how brutal their policies were towards women, as women were deprived of their basic rights of education, working out, all kinds of basic rights. Now I'm hearing different views, perhaps Taliban are divided when it comes to their view and perspective about women engagement and participation in social and political life. Right now, women still are the main target of Taliban political kind of perspective, because when they talk about peace and negotiation, one of their conditions is women Islamic rights, and their interpretation of Islamic rights of women is so different from the ones who are actually Islamic clerks, because they don't want women to go to school, their leadership. When you talk to the soldiers, to the foot soldiers, their perspective is different. So what I think is we need an international guarantor, as I said before, to make sure that women are in the negotiation table, they're part of the process, because in most of the negotiation and the talks, women are not included. So that's a kind of concern, that if the beginning there is no woman included, then of course that's a valid concern. Hopefully eventually they will come to this understanding that the women of Afghanistan have now come very far, that they will not be able to reverse.
It's interesting to me that both the Americans and to some extent the Afghan leadership refer to what is happening in Afghanistan right now as the 40-year crisis, which would cover not only the American intervention there, but obviously the Soviet one as well. From your perspective, do those great power forays into your country have anything in common?
I think as somebody who lived in Afghanistan all my life, there is one difference. The difference right now with the Mujahideen time, when the Soviet invaded Afghanistan and supported the government against the Mujahideen, that a lot of people in the rural Afghanistan were supporting Mujahideen. They were welcoming and supporting, and they were giving the space for Mujahideen, and their children were fighting against the government, then supported by Soviet Union. But when it comes to the Taliban, because people of Afghanistan have experienced the Taliban regime and kind of have the taste and the smell of what they want in this country, they don't have a lot of local and popular support at the local community. And so therefore, in many local communities, people would like to see the international forces as a signal, as a message for Taliban not to come to those villages. I think that's the difference, if I could summarize it.
But I think one of the perhaps most obvious things in common that at least I see in both how the Soviets and the Americans engaged in your country is that both tried to remake Afghanistan in their own image. Both put a lot of emphasis on the women's rights, because that was also a very major issue for the Soviets. They believed in the emancipation of women. They actually encouraged the women's participation in the labor force. And if I'm not mistaken, the 1980s actually set the historic record in Afghanistan for women in the labor force. And I would also argue both have failed in that regard. Is that how you see it?
That's true to some extent. The truth is that there are some problems women of Afghanistan are facing that has got a root in our culture and tradition. And it's very difficult to change culture and tradition overnight. We need time, we need commitment, we need resources, and political commitment above all is essential to change the perspective. There are some problems that are made by man. These are human-made problems for women, especially, for instance, when women are deprived of going to school due to the war or during the Taliban, they had to stay home. That's a problem that is created by the politicians, by the governments. And definitely we need somehow international support for those problems to get rid of it. But my argument here would be that the changes that the women of Afghanistan see today are the changes that come especially about the women's participation, it comes from the society, it comes from the grassroots level. If you go to the communities right now, people, especially women, would like to see their daughters to go to school. They would like to, you know, the changes are from the grassroots level. And I think that to reverse it, to take it back to the Taliban period, it is not possible, because here at this moment, people of Afghanistan want to see the change.
Madam Kufi, I'm sorry for jumping in, but I want to take an issue with what you just said, that it's not possible to reverse that changes, because that's obviously how the Soviets approached that issue back in the 1980s. They believed that those changes were natural. It was a natural course of history. But then the Americans came in and they started undermining many of those efforts by investing heavily in the fundamentalist propaganda. And it's well documented right now that there was a concerted American effort to present people who send their daughters to school, who allow their women to work, as infidels. Don't you think that some of those challenges that you are facing right now are in part rooted in that effort to present women's rights as alien to the Afghan society?
Absolutely true. I mean, a lot of these progress are very fragile, and it depends on how the international community will see this, or how the international community will treat these changes. I'm sure if the international community try to exit from Afghanistan, for instance, without an assurance that some of these changes will be safeguarded, history will repeat itself, and then we will perhaps face some of those same situation that we faced after the Soviets' withdrawal from Afghanistan. But in the meantime, let me also make it clear that after the Soviets' withdrawal from Afghanistan, there was a gap of civil war and a gap of Taliban regime that basically undermined all the progress that people of Afghanistan in general, and particularly women of Afghanistan, had. And therefore, when the Americans came, everything basically kind of started from scratch, while the women movement in Afghanistan has a very long history. The women participation in social and political life has a very long history. During the Soviet, also, we had a lot of schools. There is another small difference, is that back by then, many of these progresses were limited to the cities. Now, many of these progress is limited to the security. In the places which there is security and safety, you can see these progress.
Well, what I meant by American efforts to undermine women's rights in Afghanistan was the heavy investment in the Mujahideen group. And I think it is fair to say that they specifically sought back in the 80s to weaponize that culture of aggressive masculinity and intolerance towards education, especially education among the girls. Now, that was kept under certain restrictions while the Soviet troops were still in big cities, as you pointed out. But once they withdrew, I think the Taliban took over very quickly. And from what I understand from your biography, you were already a young, strong, educated woman at the time. What was it like for you to see all those gains reversed almost, not overnight, but I assume over a matter of a couple of months?
Absolutely. It was not a nice moment to see a lot of young women in Afghanistan, young girls, are deprived of their basic rights, like the rights to get out of your home and go to see a doctor. It was something that hundreds of women in Afghanistan, actually hundreds of thousands of women, experience. If you go to see a doctor, you had to be accompanied by a male companion from your family. Now, can you imagine those women who were either not married or had no male relatives in their families? They never managed to go to see a doctor. So it's true. The other truth is that during the Mujahideen time, when the Mujahideen were fighting against the Soviets back regime in Kabul, a lot of money came was invested for Mujahideen group from the Western countries and the United States, without, as you rightly said, without putting some benchmarks in terms of human rights and women's rights situation. As a result, the money was spent to support Mujahideen groups by some of the intelligence of the neighboring country on one hand. On the other hand, this money partly was used also to support other extremism and radicalized group in the region, which literally eventually they came to Afghanistan, and Afghanistan as a country that has a history of civilization was eventually used by different networks of radical groups that, you know, women were the main revenge of their policies.
Now, I want to ask you something perhaps personal, because we all assume that liberties are something that once you try them, you start taking them for granted. Why do you think the Afghan societies, all those fathers and husbands who have been sending their daughters to school, or who saw their wives going to work, why do you think they all turned their back on that?
Well, that was the sad part of it. The sad part of his, of the life during Taliban was that that the men of Afghanistan always regard their wives, their sisters, as a valuable kind of human being in their families. That's historically like that. That's why men in Afghanistan are so protective toward the women of the family. But unfortunately, during the Taliban, not only that, you know, physically our structures were kind of broken, and the government was physically, you know, not a strong government, but a brutal government, but also socially, our social values were damaged. I remember, for instance, going in the streets of Kabul, when a woman was beaten up by Taliban, her husband denied the relationship just to save himself. So not only this war and conflict actually damaged our structures and infrastructures, but it unfortunately damaged our values too.
Well, Madam Kufi, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Fazia Kufi, a member of the Afghan Parliament and prominent women's rights activist. Madam Kufi, just before the break, we were discussing why the gains in women's rights in Afghanistan dissipated so quickly once the Taliban took over. And I personally believe that's because this issue has long been presented as something the foreigners are trying to impose on the Afghan society. First, it was the Soviets. Later, it was the Westerners. And we can now see some effort, that, particularly in the West, to present the women's issues in Afghanistan as part of the Me Too movement. Do you think that's actually helpful?
Well, to be honest, there are a lot of changes since post-Taliban regime, since 2001. Change in the perspectives. Initially, yes, many people in Afghanistan would regard the support for women as a foreign agenda, as an agenda that the West and the UN and international community is in favor, because women freedom came along with the fall of Taliban, and together with this new situation that Americans and NATO came to Afghanistan. So many people in Afghanistan would regard initially, post 2001, would regard women movement and progress as part of the American or the West kind of intervention and support. But nowadays, things are changing. The perspective is changing. I think a lot of people will regard this as a domestic issue.
Well, I guess my problem with the Me Too movement and globalizing it to such extent is that it is primarily about taking on the male patriarchy, which may be the case for Western countries, but I think it's a rather limiting perspective for the rest of the world, and particularly for Afghanistan, where, as you articulated, it's not just an issue of patriarchy. It's also a very complex historic, political, geopolitical, even an economic issue, because you may educate the girls, but at the current moment, the Afghan economy doesn't have enough jobs to sustain that real empowerment. Don't you think that perhaps the Western perspective on how women are treated in Afghanistan is a little bit too narrow?
Many of these campaigns that you mentioned, the Me Too, which is part of this global feminism campaign, is very limited to the cities, or even among the cities, very limited to only few individuals. So the global change about a woman and a woman's situation actually does not impact the woman of Afghanistan's life. What I'm trying to say is, Right now, the people of Afghanistan perspective is in change. The view is in change. For instance, when I went to school, I faced a lot of challenges as a girl to go to school. But now from the same community that I come from, a lot of male come to me asking for a school for their girls because they see that there is a woman who is educated, she can do something. Now, they want good role models and examples. I think that's why I'm kind of believing that the perspective of people are changing, and that's why I think things will not reverse back to the Taliban period, because during Taliban, the social media, the media as a whole, people will not see the progress, and they have not experienced the liberty to the extent that they have experienced now, you know, the use of media and social media, etc. People now experience that. I think, yes, when it comes to the global kind of standards of women rights in Afghanistan, we are nowhere in the global standard. We still have a long way to go. But when it comes to the situation on the ground, the fact that there is a lot of positive view about women. I just give you an example. You know, we have, according to our constitution, we have a quota for women political participation. Now, we do have some women who have been elected on a general seat without, the quota. That means that the perspective at the local community is in change in support of women. But that, of course, as I said before, need a lot of resources, a lot of political commitments, and, it cannot be changed overnight.
Now, going back to that issue of talking to the Taliban, the question is how to do it, because both the Americans and the Westerners more generally have tried different approaches. Back in 2001, George W. Bush used ultimatums, which resulted in a war. On the other hand, there were times when Westerners sort of caved in to the Taliban's demands. For example, back in 1997, when a female attorney for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees was forced to talk from behind a curtain so they wouldn't see her face, which led to even more outrageous demands later on. What do you think is the optimal way of engaging this group without losing the chance for reconciliation, but also without conceding everything in the process?
Absolutely. It's a very important question, because security and justice are the two parallel process, and they will only succeed if the two processes giving equal weight and equal importance. If you don't give importance to justice, to the people's voice, to the social participation of the inhabitants of a country in a process, just focusing on security, which is a priority for us, will not result security as we want it. So justice and security must go as a parallel process, and we need to have inclusion of women. At the same Taliban that you gave example of talking to the woman from behind the curtain, I would be surprised to see their daughters studying in the Western capitals in the best universities. So it's not that they are really, really believing in what they do. It's all politics, and in politics you can always be flexible, and I hope the Taliban will be flexible in terms of their approach for women participation. And I think women should be given a voice from the beginning. They have to be part of the process, because there is this belief among our leaders that once everything is settled, then we will include women, which is a very wrong belief. You need to include women, because as you rightly said, they are the main sacrifice and victims of all these conflicts of 40 years.
One more thing that gives me some hope is that I think we now have a unique geopolitical moment when most of the regional players, the United States, Russia, China, Pakistan, support the idea of the talks between the government and the Taliban rather than trying to undermine each other covertly. So it really looks like foreigners, at least, are tired of this perpetual conflict. What about the people within the country? Have they had enough of this war?
Absolutely. There was a ceasefire announced by the government and by the Taliban during the Eid festival, the 3 days. You wouldn't believe it, although there was less clarity about, what the process would be, and there was no consultation in the process with civil society and women's groups, etc. But you wouldn't believe it that how Taliban will come with some of these full soldiers of Taliban would come to the cities to meet the ordinary city people, to go to the sightseeing places. So that is an indication of how thirsty our people is for peace. But in the meantime, let's also keep in mind that, as I indicated before, we want to have a peace with justice, like just a peace and secure country. We had it during Taliban. During Taliban, Afghanistan was absolutely a peaceful country, but there was no life. There was no freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of movement, no rights for women. So yes, we want both. We want peace, but also we want freedom as a human being.
Now, your own personal story, I think, is very heartbreaking and inspiring at the same time. When you were born, your mother left you out, essentially, to die because she wanted to have a son. But then thankfully she changed her mind, and from what I understand, she began your biggest champion in life. Is that an apt metaphor for how Afghanistan is treating its daughters?
Although this perspective is now changing in some of the families, because if you have a daughter, your daughter can go to school and she will have an income for the family. I have two daughters, which I'm very proud of them. This perspective is changing in some of the families, but still in the rural Afghanistan, there are a lot of people, a lot of men, but of course also women, who want to have a son. And the reason for women primarily is that because women suffered a lot, as my mother always gave me this example, she suffered as a woman a lot in her life. She has faced a lot of discrimination and injustice. She didn't want another girl to face as much challenges and problems as she faced. And therefore, she wanted to have a boy. Not because she didn't love a daughter, but because she didn't want another woman in this world to suffer as much as she suffered. I think my mother's perspective was rather unique on that time because, you know, I had a brother from my stepmother, and my mother also wanted to have a son, etc. But this perspective still exists in the rural Afghanistan, where people want to have son because they believe the son is the identity holder of the family. They can earn the for the family. They can present the family. Also, when it comes to the property right, the sons have more rights to access property. These are all reasons people want to have sons. But in the cities, in the urban areas, the perspective is changing, which I'm very happy about it.
Well, and some of those social changes are already reflected in the politics, as you noted earlier. In some localities, there are more men than women registered to run in the next fall's elections. I wonder if you have already made up your mind whether you are going to be competing for the parliamentary seat again.
For the parliamentary elections, definitely. I have already registered myself. And I hope that last time I was elected on a general seat, and I'm hoping that this time again I gain the same level of support and trust from my people, that I get elected not on a quota but on a general seat. And I hope that more women will also from the people from the provinces will get more general seats. That way we have more women participation in parliament, and I hope that eventually women will be in the leadership of the parliament. Why not to have a woman as a speaker of the parliament in the next parliament?
Or maybe the president of Afghanistan. I know that the elections are coming up next year. Anyway, Madam Kufi, we have to leave it here. Thank you very much for being with us today, and best of luck in your very difficult job. I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.